to
ask to assist
make part of our meeting here. This, our speaker is somebody that I met at a meeting I was going to at my sponsor's office. And I really always, I liked everything you said. I think it's really on the ball, but I've never heard your story. And one story you told at that meeting, and I always remembered it because I'm guilty of the same thing, is that sometimes I have these old apartments and people pay rent in cash. And so sometimes I pull a wad of money out of my pocket. And you told a story about having a $100 bill on the top and what your sponsor said about that. And I always remember that when I'm doing the same thing. So, Galen?
I didn't know if I was going to tell that story this morning, but I guess I was told to move this mic over in the middle so you can hear me. How's that? Are you moving it up a little bit? I'm Galen, and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is May the 20th of 2000, and that's truly by the grace of God. This program of Alcoholics Anonymous and people like you in these rooms. I am delighted to be here today for a lot of reasons. I woke up this morning, I'm delighted about that. I'm delighted to be at Club 12 because this is a very special place. And if you're new here, I know we have somebody visiting from Hawaii, and I'm going to maybe tell a story this morning about something that happened there. But if you're new and here, you don't realize this place is going to have their 70th anniversary this next year. In fact, 8 months from today, the anniversary will start. That's going to be on August the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th. And 70 years is a long time. Just think about how many people have come through here, how many lives have been saved as a result of Club 12. Not only that, when I traveled around the country, I've never seen anything quite like this. I sobered up down in the Rio Grande Valley, and AA in San Antonio is phenomenal compared to a lot of cities that I visited and where I sobered up originally. I'm just going to kind of jump right in and tell you a little bit of what it was like, what happened, what it's like now. I think I was probably born an alcoholic. Whether that's true or not, I don't know, but I think it was. I was adopted from a Salvation Army hospital when I was a year old, and I was adopted into a really wonderful family, a Christian family. All the principles that we teach here and that we have in Alcoholics Anonymous, I learned those as a child growing up. My father was a deacon in the church. My mother was a Sunday school teacher and a deaconess. My father was a very honest man. He was involved in the community. I mean, they both understood what it meant to be of service to other people. He was president of the Rotary Club. He was on the volunteer fire department. He was on the school board, president of the school board. He was on the board of directors at the bank, and he was a business owner. And, you know, he was the kind of man that his word was his bond. He told you he was going to do something, he did. He lived a life that was exemplary. And when I came along, I was totally different. I mean, I don't know why, but I never could fit into any of that. I just couldn't fit into it. I can remember, I'll tell you just a quick story. When I was 5 years old, my father said, "I want you to polish your shoes." And I looked at him and I said, "I don't want to polish my shoes." And he said, "Well, I don't care. I want you to polish your shoes." And he set me down on a little box with some shoe polish and walked away. And I just sat there. And about an hour later, he came back and said, "You need to polish your shoes." And I said, "I'm not going to polish my shoes." This is five years old. And where does this come from? I don't know. I don't know where it came from. And he said, "Well, you're going to miss dinner then tonight." And I went, "Well, that'll be fine. I won't have to ask you." And about an hour later, he came back and he said, "I'm going to spank you if you don't polish your shoes." And I went, "Well, I guess that's what's going to happen." And I did. I got a spanking pretty hard and went to paddle. I had a paddle with my name on it, by the way, on one side. My brother's is on the other side. My name wore completely off. His didn't even have a mark on it. So I got like a night and day difference. The long story short is, I went to bed that night and I said, you can spank me as many times as you want and I'm not going to polish my shoes. What do you do with a kid that's 5 years old that does that? And, you know, and I don't know why I was like that. You know, I'll give you just a quick overview of me in school, and you'll get a real clear picture. I was the kid whose desk was in the hall. And I don't mean that my desk was in the hall like just for an afternoon or a couple of days while I was going to school. I'm talking about for 12 years while I was in school. My desk was in the hall, and I was perfectly fine with that. I didn't really see anything wrong with that. And, you know, the book talks about restless, irritable, and discontent. And I can tell you that I was restless, irritable, and discontent before I ever took a drink of alcohol. And I can remember my first drink of alcohol, and I can remember what I hope is my last drink of alcohol. And my first drink of alcohol happened in the sixth grade. A little boy, there was a friend of mine, Mike. He and I stole a six-pack of Stutz malt liquor out of a neighbor's garage. And we took that six-pack down to the river, which it was cool. The water was cold, and we put it in to cool it off. I knew that it probably needed to be cold and not hot to drink it. I decided that it would be good to have a couple of cigars to smoke along with drinking our malt liquor, so we stole two cigars. And we went down the next day, and after school we went down and got a can of malt liquor. Each of us got a can of malt liquor out of the river, lit up our cigars, and started drinking this can of malt liquor. And I can tell you that I don't know exactly when it happened, but somewhere about halfway through that can of malt liquor, the magic happened for me. And the magic, the only way I can explain it is like this. It's like this huge weight was lifted off of my shoulders. It's like, I took a deep breath, and it was like the first deep breath that I'd taken in my entire life. I can tell you that my life kind of went from black and white to color. I remember what the clouds looked like when I looked at them, and how pretty they were. I remember how good I felt. I felt like I had actually arrived with that drink of malt liquor. We both drank a can of malt liquor. We smoked some of our cigars. He went home. I went home. Went to school the next day. I noticed Mike wasn't at school. And, you know, I wonder what happened to him. Where's he at? So after school, I went over to Mike's house and knocked on the door. Mike's dad came to the door and I said, "Can Mike come out and play?" Because I've been thinking all day about it. I wanted that feeling that I had the day before. I wanted to get back to the river. I wanted to get the next can of malt liquor. And Mike's dad said, "Well, Mike's in bed sick. Mike's still sick from that liquor you drank yesterday and those cigars you smoked." And he said, "And you know what? I'd really appreciate it if you didn't come back to our home to ask Mike to play." And I think my feelings were probably hurt for about 30 seconds, but that thought was supplanted with, "There's four cans of malt liquor left. There's two cigars that are, there's about three quarters of them left, and you know, I don't really need mine." I go back and get that feeling that I had. And I went back down to the river. And that feeling that I have, I chased that feeling for the next 25 or 30 years to get back to that feeling that I felt that particular day. I was, the only reason I graduated from high school is because I was a decent athlete, and as a result, my coaches would go to their teachers and say, "We need a grade, we need him to play, can you change his grade, did you get it?" And I got kind of just passed on through like that. If it wouldn't have been for that, I probably would have never graduated from high school. I was offered a four-year scholarship, what they call a full-ride scholarship, to a major university to participate in sports. My coach, who was my ally going through high school, who was always there for me, picked his family up, moved about 3 hours away to this university, took a cut in pay to be an assistant coach at the university so he could be there for me and help me and get through college and participate. And I didn't know why this happened to me, but you know, this was the thought that I had is, you know what, I've got 12 years of school, and I committed to go to school there. I'd been to the athletic room, I got in my room, I mean, everything was set to go. And about 2 weeks before it was time to go, I'm like, you know what, I don't really want to go to college. You know what, I don't think I'm going to go. So I drove down to where the university was. I went to my coach and I walked up and knocked on his door and said, you know, I've decided I'm not going to go to school. And I remember the hurt look on his face. I mean, you know, he just was so hurt. And I couldn't understand why. Well, you know, why does he, what's he so hurt about? And I left, and I never saw that man again. And I definitely owe him an amends. I've actually tried to find him, and I don't think he's still living. But what I know today, what I can tell you today, is the reason I didn't take that scholarship is because my drinking had already reached a point where I knew I couldn't do the workouts, that I couldn't do what was going to be required of me, and that I wouldn't be able to make it happen. And so rather than even take a look at that, I just moved on with my life. I did what I did with everybody. I burned bridges behind me. You know, I can describe my drunk log real easily, you know. And you know, just to back up for a minute, you know, that kid sitting out in the hall, the big book describes alcoholics as maladjusted to life. That's one of the descriptions, maladjusted to life. And, you know, a kid who doesn't get to go into school that has to sit in the hall for 12 years is probably pretty maladjusted to life, don't you think? And so, you know, my drunk log is real simple. You know, one of the things I like in the book is that it describes us so accurately. It talks about a tornado. We're a tornado roaring through people's lives, destroying sweet relationships, and that was pretty much me. The kind of things that happened to me when I drank were, and I can describe them. Usually they were the same things. They were pretty much the same thing that happened. One is I wrecked a lot of automobiles. I don't know how many automobiles, but a lot. And you know what would happen is that I would drink and get out there and drive and, you know, run into somebody. Or I had a lot of one-car accidents. There was nobody else there but just me. And then I wake up the next day and go, I wonder where my car's at. You know, it's not in the driveway. I don't know what happened to it. So, you know, that was one of the things that happened to me a lot. But another thing that happened to me when I was drinking is that, and this is a real good example because this actually happened. My wife said, I called her from work, and I said, I'm on my way home. And she said, great. We've got such and such happening tonight. I don't know if we need to go to school for the kids. I don't know what needed to happen. Or we had company coming over. It's 5:10, and I'm getting in my car, and I'm going to drive home. And she says, well, don't forget, we've got some. All right, I'll be there in a few minutes. I'll see you in a little bit. See, I didn't know what an alcoholic was. I had to come here to understand what an alcoholic was. I thought an alcoholic lived under a bridge. I thought an alcoholic had a paper bag. I thought an alcoholic didn't have a home or a car. That's what I thought it took to be an alcoholic. What I know now is none of those things had anything to do with being an alcoholic. So what had happened to me is on my way home, I would think to myself, well, you know, I need to stop and get a pack of cigarettes. And instead of stopping at a convenience store, I would stop at a bar because I'd drive by and go, oh, well, there's so-and-so's car there at the bar. And maybe I'll just go in, buy a pack of cigarettes, maybe have one drink, and then because I've got to be at school tonight, and then I'll go on home. And, of course, you know the rest of the story is that once I pick up that first drink, then all bets are off. And that's what I had to come here and find out from you, is that it wasn't the 10th drink, it wasn't the other outside issues that I did that got me in trouble, it was the first drink. You know, it wasn't the caboose that ran over me, it was the engine that ran over me. And so here's how this would end up, is that I wouldn't go home that night. I might not go home the next night, and I might not go home the next night after that. And I wouldn't call, and I wouldn't say anything. And I'd come out of a blackout, and I'd be in Las Vegas. From Houston, Texas to Las Vegas. Not really remember how I got there, not know what happened. I can tell you that the sickest the women were in my life, and they had to be pretty sick to be with me. You know, when you're with a full-blown alcoholic, you know, there's something wrong with you. And I don't know how many Al-Anons are in here today. You know, to even think you can fix somebody like me, you know, that's kind of, you know, kind of weird to think. Well, you know, once I get him, he'll be okay. I'll be able to straighten him out. That's the kind of thing that happened, you know. And they stick around for a while, depending on how sick they are. They might give me a second try of that. Usually, about a third time, they're gone. It's a divorce. I'm out of here. I'm gone. And that was a repeat process with me. I reached a bottom, and I told you about my first drink, and I kind of told you what it was like. And I'm going to spend most of the rest of the time up here telling you what it's like now, because I have a wonderful life, and it's all due to you people in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I walked into AA for my very first meeting on September the 3rd, 1989, and I went there for a reason, because my current wife was not too happy with me. I had passed out and caught her house on fire and almost burned it down, and she said, "I can't live like this anymore." So I went to AA and I walked in, and I wanted what she had, sort of. You know, I was kind of one of those want-to-stop-drinking kind of guys. And I did a little bit of time, and I go back out. And I did a little bit of time, and I go back out. And one of the biggest holdups, the biggest problem for me, if you're new here today, listen to this, the fourth step. See, I was unique. I had problems that nobody else understood. You didn't know how bad I was. I had these secrets that I could never tell anybody, and if I told you, you know, I'd have to kill you after I told you. I mean, this is my alcoholic thinking. And I fought this four-step thing, you know, doing this four-step. You know, and I had a sponsor. I picked a guy who kind of let me tell him what to do. And if you have that kind of sponsor that lets you tell him what to do, get a new sponsor. Now, don't have somebody that lets you tell them what you need to do. And he told me, "We got to do the four step. We got to do the four step. We got to do the four step." And I said, "Well, you don't understand. You don't understand. You don't understand. I don't write. I don't write. I don't write. So I can't do it. I don't write letters. I don't sign checks. I don't write. Period. I don't write. So I can't do the four step." So, you know, I don't know, I had a little bit of time sober, and so I decided one night to go home and get one of these pocket tape recorders out and record my four-step, what I thought would be a four-step, on this pocket recorder. And I spent a couple hours, I went through a couple of tapes, and I took it back to him, and I said, "Well, here you go, here's my four-step." And he kind of looked at me like, "Yeah," and then he told me what I could do with that recorder and the tapes. And I don't know if I said this or not, but I might have. I thought that I probably needed to get them back because there was probably a best-selling book on those tapes. That's how sick it was. I mean, you know, I really thought that drunk log really carried some kind of weight in there, something anybody would ever want to hear. But what happened to me is, I got 5 years. I never really did an inventory. I left out all the worst things. I'm telling you all the things wrong to do. If you're new in here, do not even try this, because it won't work. And I went back out after struggling for years in this program and not you know, got to get some sobriety, things would be okay. One time I had 5 years of sobriety, and I went back out. Because what happens is you can't hold on to these secrets. You can't live this sickness. You know, this is a 12-step program. It's not a 3-step program. People can stay sober for a while on 3 steps, but your life doesn't change. You know, the hardest thing that I can think of, and I've got to watch some sponsees, is come in and get sober and not have a program. You want to see real insanity? That's insanity. Try to do this. If you're a real alcoholic like I am, and you can find me in the book, I'm on page 21, I'm the real alcoholic, the hopeless variety alcoholic. The last 3 years of my drinking were the worst ones that I had. You know, in that last two to three years, every day I would get up and I'd say, I'm going to quit today. This is it. I'm done. I'm not going to drink today no matter what. I'm done. And before the day was over, I was drinking again. And then the next day, I'd get up and I'd do the same thing. I repeated this day after day after day for several years. Until I reached a point, and this is my last drink, and which I hope is my last drink, is that I reached a point where I couldn't take any more of me. I burned my life to the ground. Now, my family didn't want me around. The people that I drank with, that I thought were friends, I'd call at 4 in the afternoon and go, well, where are we meeting for happy hour? And they'd say, oh, we're going to be over at such and such. And I'd go there and they wouldn't show up. And they wouldn't answer their phones. I mean, they didn't want anything to do with me. So, my last night of drinking, the guy that I was drinking with, I remember we were at a hotel bar. I was living in a hotel because my family didn't want me at the house. He left. I went up. I went to the room, passed out. I was living at a hotel because I finally controlled my drinking and driving. You know, at one point, I heard somebody say, well, you know what I do? And I went, what? He goes, I used to have car wrecks like you do. And you know what I do? He goes, I take my car keys and I put them in a coffee can full of water and I put them in the freezer. And they're frozen, so that way I can't get them out and drink and drive. And I thought, well, that's a pretty good idea. And then I thought, well, what if I need a pack of cigarettes? Then what am I going to do? Well, you know, what if? So that didn't work. So what I had resigned myself to was drinking in hotel bars because all I had to do was get in the elevator, go up, and get in bed. That's where my life was. I mean, I was drinking pretty much around the clock, I mean, 24 hours a day. And I woke up that next morning in the hotel room, and I looked around, and, I had drugs laying there. And my story is that, I had a lot of outside issues, and I just to make it short and quick, I'd take anything that would make me change the way I felt. See, I couldn't live with me the way I felt. Now, I've heard that described as a soul sickness, and for me, it was a soul sickness. I had all these holes in my soul, and there was never enough of anything to fill it up. It wasn't enough money. It wasn't enough things. It wasn't enough of anything to fill those holes. And that last day when I woke up, I looked around. Here I am in this motel, and I've got a bottle of Jack Daniels, some other drugs laying on the bed, a gun. And I'm trying to decide, well, which one should I do first to start my day with? You know, I mean, I need to get going. It's noon. They're probably wondering where I'm at the office. I need to just check in. And I thought, well, I'm going to call my friend from the night before. And so I called his house, and his wife answered. And I asked if he was there. And she said, no, you're SOB. She said, he got arrested again. Our third DWI, he's in jail. He's probably going to go to prison. And, what are we going to do? What are the kids going to do? It's all your fault. And, at that time in my life, I really thought it was my fault. I mean, I remember that moment thinking, you are an SOB. I mean, look at your life. Your family doesn't want you. Your last friend in the world is in jail. What are you going to do? And I looked in the mirror and I had what we describe in Alcoholics Anonymous as a moment of clarity. And that moment of clarity, I believe, is a conscious contact with God. I looked at that and I went, I can't go anymore. I can't do anymore. I can't take any more of this. What can I do? What can I do? And I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous. And I came in with a totally different attitude. And I'm going to tell you what that attitude is. That attitude was, I'll do anything I have to do. I was given that gift of desperation. That's a gift. That gift of desperation. A lot of people, it takes a long time. You know, if you're new here and you think you're on your bottom, let me tell you, there's one below that one. There's a bottom below your bottom. It can get worse. And, you know, I had reached the bottom. My only choice was Alcoholics Anonymous or suicide. That's where I was at. And, you know, it had to work. And so if you'd have told me, I want you to go stand in the corner on your head, that's what you need to do, then that's what I would have done. And I'm so grateful for the club that I walked into. I walked into the shared group of Alcoholics Anonymous down the Rio Grande Valley in McAllen, Texas. And, you know, I don't know if there were short of newcomers in there, but, you know, when they saw I was a newcomer, I had people all over me, old timers. You know, I like to describe it like ducks on a June bug. I mean, they were all over me. And, you know, they said, I didn't get a desire chip. And they asked me why after the meeting. And I said, well, because I know I can't stay sober for 24 hours, and that's a 24-hour chip. I know I can't do that. And they said, well, can you stay sober for an hour? And I said, yes, I can. I can do an hour. What about two? Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I can do two. What about four? Well, yeah, I can do four. Great. We have another meeting here. We're going to hang out with you. We're going to go to another meeting today. And that's how I started Alcoholics Anonymous. I lived here. I came in and I lived in Alcoholics Anonymous. Those old-timers, they took me with them where they went. They said, come on and join us. Let's go have breakfast. Come on, we're going to go have lunch. Come and go with us. I had a sponsor, and his name was Dennis. And Dennis took me through the steps, and we went through them in 6 months. And when I got to the fourth step, I said, Dennis, you don't understand. I don't write. And he said, well, guess what, Galen? You don't understand. You don't have to write. God will do the writing for you. He said, I want you to write at the top of the page, God, guide my hand to write the things that need to be written. Give it a try. See what happens. And I sat down with that pad and paper, and I wrote at the top of the page exactly what he asked me to do. And what happened was, is it turns out God is a prolific writer. Because I had pages within just a very short few minutes. And I can tell you that today, anytime I write, anytime I do a step work, I invite God into it. I write at the top of the page, God, guide my hand to write the things that I need to be written. And if you're worried about the fourth step, you don't have to do it. Let God do it. Because He'll do a way better job than I was able to do. So we went through the steps. You know, I had a guy named Larry. And Larry was, he wasn't my sponsor. I think he thought he was my sponsor. Because Larry would say things to me like, he would go, well, Galen, what are you doing on Saturday morning? And I'd go, well, you know, usually Saturday morning I just kind of sit around, relax, don't do very much on Saturday morning. He goes, good, well, I'm going to come pick you up. So I'll be there about 7 o'clock in the morning. And I went, okay. So he picked me up. I go, where are we going? He said, we're going over to the club. It needs to be cleaned before the meeting today. And, you know, here's a scrub brush and a toilet brush, and I'm putting you in charge of toilets today. We got the men's restroom and the women's restroom. Where I sobered up was in a bar, by the way. It was an old bar. Still had bar stools, dance floor. For Saturday night, candlelight meeting, we could turn on the disco ball around on top, because it was right over the top where we met. It's truly a full bar. And they had men's restrooms and women's restrooms. You know, Larry another time said to me, what do you do on Sunday evenings? And I go, well, you know, usually I just watch TV on Sunday evenings. I don't, you know, do a lot on Sunday evenings. He said, good, I'm going to come by and pick you up. I've got a meeting I want you to go to with me. I went, okay, well, great. So where are we going? And he said, well, we're going to go up to this correctional facility and take a meeting in the correctional facility. And I went, oh, okay. I said, what kind of meeting is it? And he goes, it's a speaker meeting. And I went, oh, great. Who's the speaker? And he goes, that'll be you. I go, well, I haven't been sober very long. I mean, what am I going to tell him? And he goes, tell him what it was like for you and what it's like now. He said, you got enough sobriety, you can share at least a little bit of what it's like now. And, you know, thank God for those old timers that got a hold of me and got me involved in service work. I wasn't going to tell this story, but I'm going to tell it. Because Larry said, you know what, I think it'd be a good idea for you, Galen, is that every day you do something for somebody else and don't tell anybody about it. And I went, well, okay. You know, so, you know, I tried doing some things, and he would question me, what'd you do today? Did you do something today? Well, yeah, what'd you do? Well, I stopped on the way to work, I got out, I picked up a newspaper at the street, and I carried it up, and I laid it on the porch. Okay, very good, you did something. So one day Larry says, what did you do today for somebody else that you didn't tell anybody about? And I go, well, I didn't do anything. And he said, well, why not? I said, I couldn't think of anything to do. He said, well, I can think of something for you to do. He goes, you know, you're Mr. Flash. You always got to pull out this roll of bills out of your pocket. You always got these $100 bills flipping out there. See, I wanted you to think I was really successful. I thought if you could see how much money was in my pocket, you might like me. That was the old way of thinking, you know. He said, here's what I want you to do. He said, I want you to take one of those $100 bills, and I want you to go down here, and he gave me a street. I want you to go down here on this street, and I want you to take $100 bill out of your pocket, put it in an envelope, and put it in a mailbox. I asked God, which mailbox do you need to put it in? And it was one of the bars that was down the valley. And I can remember looking at him, and I don't know if I said this or not, but I think I said, are you shitting me? And he said, no, I'm not. And so I did it. Remember, you know, I mean, these sponsors, they're kind of tricky. You said, you know, at the very beginning, they say things like, are you willing to go to any length to get this? What does that mean? Well, it means when I ask you to do something, you'll go do it. Oh, well, yeah, I'll do that. So, and then if you balk, they remind you. Remember when you said you're willing to go to any length? Take that $100 bill down there and put it in. Okay, here I go. And I learned a lot from that experience. One of the things that I learned from that experience is that, A, if I have a $100 bill, you will never know about it. I might have one in my pocket right now, but you're not going to know about it. And B, don't ever tell your sponsor you can't think of anything to do. Another thing that Larry would say to me, I called him one day, and I said, Larry, you know, I'm having this problem with so-and-so, and I mean, I was really upset. They did this, said that, you know, I'm not going to put up with this, I got such a, what do you think I should do? And he said, you know what I'd like you to do? I'd like you to go over to HEB and get all the grocery carts that are out in the parking lot, and gather them all up, and take them back up and put them away where they need to go. And when you finish with that, give me a call back. And it was about 105 degrees that day down there, and I'm out there gathering up grocery carts and putting them in there. And I'm thinking to myself, he doesn't understand. You know, did he not hear what I said the problem was? You know, why am I out here doing these grocery carts? And, what is wrong with him? Anyway, I got them all put away. I don't know, probably took, it's a while, and it's a big parking lot. And I called him back, and he said, so how do you feel? And I said, well, I feel pretty good. He said, do you feel better because you went and did something for somebody and did something? And I said, well, yeah, I do. And he said, well, what about that other thing? And I said, what other thing? You see, I forgot about what was bothering me. And I tell you that because the main problem with an alcoholic, if you're a real alcoholic like me, is on page 62, selfishness and self-centeredness. That, we think, is the root of our troubles. I have to get out of me. I got to get out of me, and I got to get out of me. And until I get out of me, I can't do anything. I can't hear what my higher power has to say to me. I can't be really of service to anybody until I get out of me. You know, that page also says the alcoholic is the extreme example of selfishness. The extreme example. So it doesn't matter how long I've been sober. You know, what I have to do today is get out of me. And, you know, I love something that Jim says. You know, Jim W., who I admire immensely, has helped me, you know, beyond words. He says something a lot, and I try to live this, and that is, you can't live on yesterday's bread, and you can't live on yesterday's spirituality. So what are you going to do today? This is one day at a time. You know, I talked to a guy here with 6 months that came in here this morning. He got up at 3 o'clock this morning. He might be the most sober guy in the room because it's one day at a time. Whoever got up the earliest this morning has the most sobriety today. Some wonderful things have happened to me while I've been sober. So I'm going to share just a few stories. One of them is I got to be a team leader for the international convention when I was here. And you know, which is, I got to tell you, is one of the most wonderful experiences of my life. As a team leader, we were asked to be down there on a Monday when the convention didn't start until Friday. So, you know, I'm like, okay, well, yeah, whatever, I'll be there. And, you know, I wonder, what are we going to do for 4 days before the convention starts? Well, when we got there, I saw what we were going to do. There were pallets and pallets and pallets on forklifts stacked up of literature, of things that are going to be handed out at the International Convention. There was a ton of work to be done. There were 5,000 volunteers. You know, Jim B. was the person who was the organizer. It's an immense job. And what happened is we were given these green shirts. And y'all were around here for a while. You know that 2010 bright green leprechaun-y looking shirt? Well, I had one of those on, and I walked out on the street on Monday morning. And I hadn't taken but just a few steps, and a couple stopped me from England, and they said, "Are you with the convention?" And I said, "Yes, I am." And they said, "Well, what are you doing? We're looking for a place to eat. We got here early. We're looking for a place to go eat." And I said, "Well, I'm going down to the silo down here. It's a few blocks from the convention center. They got good sandwiches. I'm heading down there." And they said, "Can we go with you?" I go, "Absolutely, love to have you go with me." So we started walking. To make a long story short, by the time we got to the silo, there were 20 people in this group from all over the country. Some of the most wonderful people you could ever hope to meet in your life. We got a great big table. We put it together. Everybody's laughing. They're kidding. If you were an outsider in the silo, you'd think we were a family because of the way we were laughing and enjoying ourselves. And for me, you are my family. You know, this is my family. My first couple of years in sobriety, I spent every Christmas and every Thanksgiving cooking turkeys at the club. The first year that we cooked turkeys there, I think we cooked 3. The second year, some people came up and said, "You know, that turkey you guys cooked was really good. Would you cook one of ours?" Yeah, so we went to 6. And then the last year before I moved up here, I think we cooked 11 or 12 turkeys that year. I don't remember how many. But, you know, it's that service work, Unity Service and Recovery. We have a symbol in here. If you're new in here, it's a circle and a triangle. And the circle stands for the unity of all of the people in the world. I mean, you know, not just this group here. You know, what I got to see at the International Convention is how big this thing really is. People from all over the world that showed up to go to that convention. And, you know, I have to do all of those things. This is something that Jim told me, and he said there are different levels of alcoholics. And he goes, on a scale of 1 to 10, you're like up there at a 10. You're the real alcoholic. You're that real guy, that real thing. Because one of the things that I've wondered about is how somebody can go to one meeting a week, never do any service work, never sponsor anybody, and stay sober. Because I can't do that. I am the real alcoholic. I have to sponsor people. I have to be involved in service work. I have to go. I'm a 4-meeting-a-week guy, just to tell you that. I mean, I'll do more than 4, but I need 4. And I have a barometer, and it kind of tells me how I know if I need four meetings. And if you've been around here for a while, you kind of get to know how many meetings you need. And my barometer kind of works like this. It's like when I only do three meetings a week, I don't think about drinking. But what happens is the people on the freeways, they just don't do right. You know, they're just people in these rooms, they start to irritate. I start looking at people's sharing in the meeting, and I go, oh, she'd shut up. Things like that. That's what happens to me when I don't do four meetings a week. When I do four meetings a week, I do pretty well. So I know that that's what it takes for me, is I need those four meetings a week. That night, the Friday night opening, when we went to the convention center, there were 53,000 people in the Alamo Dome, all holding hands. And I've got to tell you that I've never experienced anything like that ever before in my whole life. Words will not describe what that feeling is like. You have to experience it. Being at that convention and going through that convention is one of the most awesome things that's ever happened. And, you know, after it was over with, I'd see people. And there were people that, I got to tell you a little bit, one of the things that I did as a team leader is I worked with people that needed scholarships, that came in and didn't have the money to go. You know, I talked to people that hitchhiked. They hitchhiked all the way from Michigan to be here just to be in that convention. I talked to people that rode a motorcycle with just enough gas to get here from California to be at that convention because they wanted it, they needed it. And they wanted that awesome experience. And then after it was over with, I talked to people here in San Antonio and I said, did you go to the convention? No. Why not? Oh, I didn't want to deal with parking downtown. Oh, well, I'm sorry. Man, that'd be a tough one having to deal with parking. I mean, they had 50 buses that pick you up everywhere to ride down there. You don't even have to park downtown. But that was an awesome experience. You know, I want to share some things that had happened to me. I'm going to have to do this real quick because I'm running out of time. I never was able to make an amends to my father. My father died, but never seeing me draw a sober breath. And so, you know, one of the things I did is I wrote a letter and burned it. Another thing that I did is I winter gravesite, made a direct amends at the gravesite. But it never really felt like quite enough. Like, there was still something that needed to happen there. And so my sponsor at that time said, why don't you adopt a father? Just go find somebody that needs help. You know, go try to be the son you never were to your father. Go pick somebody out and be there for that person. And so I did that, and it turned out to be my father-in-law. And, you know, we had a wonderful relationship until he passed away. I mean, an absolutely wonderful relationship. He would, when he would see me at the door, he would jump out of his chair, he'd stop whatever he would do, and he'd come over, and he'd run over, and he'd give me a big hug. And he'd say, I love you, when he was giving me that hug. And several times he told me something that I've never shared from the podium, but I'm going to share it right now, if I can do it. He said, if I ever had a son, I'd want him to be just like you. Now, I got to tell you, it doesn't get any better than that. You know, this program, and this is because of you, going back, and cleaning up the wreckage of the past. I was able to, when he passed away, I adopted somebody else in the program. And tried to do the same thing for them until they passed away. So, you know, this program's been amazing. This journey's been amazing. The last thing I want to share with you is that I had a wonderful relationship with my mother until she passed away. She passed away maybe 1 year ago next week. And things happen to us in sobriety. You know, and what I'm going to say about this is, see, it doesn't matter what happens. I have tools today. This is a design for living that works, whether life's good or whether it's bad. I'm grateful for good things, but I'm also grateful for the bad things that happen as well. And the reason I'm grateful for them is because they teach me. You know what? If everything was good, I'd never learn anything. I would never learn it. I would never grow spiritually if everything was a bed of roses. So the last years of my mother's, we had almost a 30-year wonderful relationship. My father's been dead over 30 years. And when she was 90, I had a birthday party for her. And I took out an ad in the paper. They have a countywide paper and invited everybody in the county to come. She had about 150, 180 guests that came. It was just a phenomenal event for her. She was like queen for the day. And all these people showed up. It was just a wonderful, wonderful day for her. We took pictures, we had cake, we had ice cream, you know, we did the whole thing. And she enjoyed it so much, I said, you know, I'm going to do this every year for the rest of her life. But she lived to be 97 years old, so we had seven more birthday parties after that. And they were all wonderful parties. She loved every one of them. The last one, she was not doing well. In fact, the next day after the party, she said, were you at my party? Yes, I was. I was at your party. She passed away, and I got to deliver the eulogy at her funeral. And what I'm going to tell you about that is that I went from the black sheep of the family to being someone that was respected and loved in our family. I got to stand up in front of people and say, I have no regrets with my family, with my mother. You know, we had a wonderful relationship. I loved her. I got to tell funny stories to her, about her, to the people that she knew. And at the when we went down to the gravesite, she had a full funeral, open casket, the whole thing. We went to the gravesite. I read something that was, I think, that really epitomized the woman that she was. She was, one of the things we played at her funeral was a video of her for the news channel from Wichita, Kansas, came out and did an interview with her because she had been delivering Meals on Wheels for 25 years until she was 91 years old. And she said, you know, the greatest gift I have is being able to give back to people. And she said, I think that's why we're here. So we can do that. And I was able to read the St. Francis prayer at her gravesite, which was really epitomized the woman that she was. So I'm out of time. What I want to tell you is that I have a great life today, and it's because of AA. If you're new here, you're 12 steps away from a brand new life. It's just 12 steps. Get a sponsor. Go through the steps. The best years of your life lie ahead. And, you know, when I came in here, I thought, well, I'm through. You know, this is, look where I have sunk to. Alcoholics Anonymous, look where I have sunk to. My sponsor said, I told him, I said, you know what, I'm here. I guess besides not drinking, I'm going to go ahead and lose weight. I'm going to stop smoking. I'm going to do these things. And he said, why don't we just see if you can stay sober? Really good advice. If you're new in here, don't try any of those other things. Just see if you can stay sober for a little while.
Oh, so,
thank you very much for being here.